Simple Beep, Episode 89, macOS 10 at 20. Hello, and welcome back to Simple Beep, a podcast looking back at the history of Apple and the Mac community. I'm Ed Cormony.
And I'm Brian Sartorius.
And it's been almost, well, it's been a little bit over a year since we last recorded an episode of Simple Beep, if you follow the calendar, or if you follow your heart, it's probably more like a decade.
Yeah.
The reason that we're back and what we're going to be talking about on this episode is a huge decade milestone, and it's the fact that macOS 10 is turning 20 years old as of the release of this episode.
And it's wild because in 20 years, the 10 has only gone up to 11.
I mean, I think it's actually quite remarkable that it has proceeded to 11. And of course, we will get to that at the very end. We always like to catch up to where we are in the present day. And that's at, what, like 11.2.3 or something?
So something like that, yeah. Should we do any follow-up?
I think everyone's had a year, and we're all caught up.
So yeah, so before we get into the actual release of macOS 10 20 years ago and what it was and what it came to be and how it defined the 20 years that followed, of course, there's a story about the development period and what led up to the actual public release of macOS 10.
A rather disastrous development period for some time.
And actually, we have covered one of the initial steps, the initial seeds of the idea of macOS 10 in our episode 81 about the next transition, because of course a lot of the intellectual property that became macOS 10 actually came over to Apple from Next. And then of course macOS 10, as we come to know it, being the consumer focused operating system that runs on all of our MacBooks, or back then PowerBooks and Power Macs and eventually Mac Pros and always iMacs, wasn't actually the first public release of this next generation operating system. You were able to get something that was titled macOS 10 before there was actually the macOS 10 we all think of. And that was macOS 10 Server, which came out at the start of 1999 and lasted almost to the end of October. And true to its name, it was a server grade OS. And there have been different versions of macOS Server that kind of kept pace with the consumer-facing macOS 10, but it didn't look like Aqua in macOS 10.
No, it was quite obviously a version of Next Step with a Platinum interface glued on top of it. And I think that presaged a fairly strange history for macOS Server over many years. The fact that Apple maintained these ostensibly two distinct operating systems as macOS 10, the consumer version, and macOS 10 Server, the server version, was a little bit odd because I used macOS 10 Server like a couple times and it really just felt like a usual installation of macOS with a couple additional apps that gave a couple additional features. And so it was a little bit weird. I think it makes sense that it was the first one and was so obviously rooted in the Next heritage, because the very existence, or the decision to have these two forks of the operating system, feels very Nexty, that they would think that, oh, well, the way that we set up computing systems is that there are servers and there are clients and that they should behave differently.
Now that I think about it, I think I may have also used one of the later releases of macOS 10 Server. And just judging it by name, my mind goes to like a web server kind of for the public internet. But the additional apps that you mentioned seemed more, when I briefly interacted with it, like it was for a corporate intranet. Like there was stuff with Wiki and contact and email management within a single domain.
Right. So maybe it was Apple itself who got the most use out of macOS 10 Server, building all kinds of internal tools on it and keeping all of their precious corporate data close to the vest.
That's what .Mac was run off of. That's why it was bad.
Oh, no.
Anyway, macOS 10 Server was the first public facing release of something with the macOS 10 name. But we are talking about the kind of single installation version of macOS 10. But even still, the version 10.0 that came out 20 years ago, as you listen to this, wasn't the first thing. It didn't just appear out of nowhere. Much like the modern cadence of announcing a beta at WWDC and then releasing it later in the fall, there were advanced copies that got better and better leading up to the release of macOS 10. And it started with a purely developer preview, not a kind of mixed developer beta, public beta like we have today.
Yeah, it feels very much like the old way of distributing things, but again, has that echo in today where the developer beta comes out as soon as the keynote presentation is over at WWDC and the public have to at least wait a couple of months. In this case, it was several months, as the first developer preview was, in fact, announced at WWDC, totally making sense there, in 1999. But then the public didn't get any kind of access until over a year later in September of 2000.
The developer preview of macOS 10 went through four major versions, like things you had to update and install and start using over again. And the first two of those four were kind of like macOS 10 server. They still had the platinum appearance of the classic macOS that was outgoing and soon to be laid to rest in a casket. So it wasn't until Developer Preview 3, which was released during Macworld at the start of 2000, that we saw one of the tentpole features of macOS 10, the Aqua user interface. And boy, is there a lot to talk about here.
And of course, it made a huge splash. It was not introduced at WWDC, which back around 2000 was more of a second tier event. It was at the primary Apple event of the year at Macworld. And it was, everyone assumed that there would be a huge interface refresh with the long awaited reboot of the operating system. And in that respect, it did not disappoint. Of course, it came with the famous Aqua desktop background, all in shades of blue, the lickable window widgets, including some new widgets that people didn't know exactly what they were for, an infamous Apple logo put in the middle of the menu bar, and pinstripes. Oh, the pinstripes.
Pinstripes everywhere, some translucent, some not.
Some extremely translucent to the point of illegibility. So it was quite a bit of a shock. And I think, again, we have to think back to how we processed Apple news in the year 2000. And the fact that high definition live streams of Apple keynotes were not a thing. At best, you were going to have good live blog coverage. And most likely, you were waiting on magazine coverage to come weeks later to get the full story. So there was this room for rumors and just plain out falsehoods about what this new interface did to percolate in that intervening time. And I think the most pernicious one was that Steve Jobs introduced the new version of macOS 10 and you can only have one window at a time, which was not strictly speaking true. The developer preview definitely did allow you to have more than one window at a time, but it also had a button that prevented you from having more than one window at a time. And while everyone in the audience, I think, was horrified by this notion, Steve Jobs seemed really into it during the presentation. He turned on this mode, and everyone was extremely confused about whether the computer that they were seeing on screen was a Mac or not anymore. So I have a quote here from Tidbits. This was later on, about 10 years ago, when someone discovered that there was code that still corresponded to this mode lurking in macOS. Oh, man. They say, back in 1999, when Steve Jobs first showed off the new Finder in macOS 10, it ran a single application mode, where switching from one application to another caused the first application to minimize. This was the original demo of the Genie effect. This was intended to be the default behavior, but it was so widely reviled that Apple quickly changed the default.
they loved those, like, processor intensive, GPU intensive transitions or effects, like the Genie effect, which I think still to this day you can slow down, so you can, you know, bask in the full glory of the Genie effect. Or thinking about the single window mode, the single application mode, fast user switching, I think, used to have the full screen transition of like a cube rotating faces, and each face was a different logged in user.
Oh, it still does.
It still does? Oh my God.
But yeah, these were the things that they were showing off. And of course, the Genie effect, smooshing a window down in real time, was remarkable.
As the QuickTime window, the movie still plays in the QuickTime window as it's being minimized and it continues in the dock. Yeah, it was some really big stuff. Really cool.
Right, because in Mac OS 9, if you resized a window, you got a little gray outline.
Obviously, the Aqua interface was the big new reveal in Developer Preview 3. Developer Preview 4 added some additional enhancements, bug fixes. You know how that works. And then Mac OS 10 entered a public beta, like Ed said, in September of 2000. And this was not something that you could just sign up and get on the beta certificate track and download. This was a paid product.
Well, and it had to be. It was distributed on physical media. So it made sense that you were going to exchange money for being able to get your hands on a copy of the public beta. So it launched in September of 2000, and it was $29.95 at retail and introduced a few final things for people to put through their paces before Mac OS X was official.
I think one of the big bundled apps that came along with Mac OS X was Mail.app, which continues to this day and is maybe the subject of criticism, depending on how much you like it and how much you use it. But there were a bunch of other bundled apps of varying size and utility that came with Mac OS X. Some were modern counterparts of things that came bundled with classic Mac OS, like you used to have Teach Text and Simple Text, and in Mac OS X, you had Text Edit. But there were a couple that were only with the public beta and didn't make it through to the final release shipping version. And I think the one that I definitely fixated on in magazine screenshots and previews was something called Music Player, because this is a really narrow time window. There was still no iTunes. Perhaps the SoundJam MP acquisition had happened and they were quickly scurrying to make iTunes out of SoundJam, but at the time of the public beta's release, there was no first-party application for playing these MP3 files that were starting to show up on your computer.
Yeah, it's a four-month gap between those.
So they had in the public beta this app called Music Player, which had a very early Mac OS X looking interface that I think was repurposed into an Audion skin, and that's what I used for many months, and a playlist. Actually, in retrospect, it was just a lot like Audion, a separate playlist window where you could add MP3 files from your hard disk and arrange them. There were no iPods yet to manage, and I doubt it interfaced with things like the Diamond Rio. So it was a music player for local MP3 files, where I guess before you were using a third-party app or QuickTime player. We'll get to some of the other technologies that Mac OS X introduced, specifically the Quartz drawing layer. And there was another app included with the public beta that was not in the shipping version of Mac OS X called Sketch, which was to demonstrate the power of the Quartz graphic subsystem moving on from Display PostScript. So Windows has MS Paint. The Mac OS X public beta had Sketch, which was vector-based, whereas Paint is famously low-res bitmap. I mentioned Text Edit. This is something that I've only read about. I've never seen. I would have loved to see what this was, but it was an app called HTML Edit, which for all that I've read, sounds like it's maybe a version of these Markdown apps that we still have today, where you write in, I guess in modern days, Markdown, and you can have another pane where you see the output of your Markdown. And this was you write in HTML, and there's a pane that shows you your finished product of HTML. And again, at the time, you were probably doing Claire's homepage or Adobe Dreamweaver. And this was a nice little bundled app for bare bones web authoring. The final app was something specifically for the public beta. It was simply called bomb.app. The bomb is a relic of the classic macOS, signifying, you know, a hard crash, a hard freeze. macOS 10 would have kernel panics. And if you wanted to trigger a hard crash, they just built an app that would do that, bomb.app.
And apparently this was used in one of the demonstrations, I think maybe the DP3 demonstration at Macworld, to show off the new memory architecture, that you could have some kind of just deliberate critical failure within an app, but not bring down the rest of the operating system, and everybody cheered.
Simpler times, man. The big win was preemptive multitasking in your memory space.
Yeah. I mean, I've actually had a couple of hard crashes on my Mac in the last few months. I blame Google. I blame Google Meet. And it's a very jarring experience when the mouse just stops moving and everything goes dead and all the pixels stay fixed in place and your music cuts out. And it's an experience that is few and far between now, but was like daily or hourly as being a Mac user, depending on how many extensions you had prior to macOS 10.
Something you just said gave me a very specific sense flashback, because you said your music stopped. But back in the old days, if you were using Apple CD audio player, which was literally using the CD drive in your Mac as a CD player, kind of writing to a different buffer outside the system, your music would keep playing.
I don't think that there was any CPU processing being done on that, that they bought CD drives off of the shelf where the part itself decodes the audio and sends it out to the speaker, and the software was just controlling that, and it was hardware to hardware. So as long as you kept the power fed to it, it would keep playing your music.
Yeah, that was the public beta, maybe like a 6-month period where for $30, you could be one of the first to experience the next generation Mac operating system.
And I know for sure that, you know, the place in life where we were in the year 2000, I did not have $30 to spend on experimental software, nor a computer all of my own to install it on. So I have no primary experience with the public beta.
I think we have secondary experience because we had an enterprising friend at our high school who ran a side business, because I think he was the first person at our high school with a CD burner and with DSL at home. So he would kind of take requests for songs and make you mix CDs. But he also, I remember, spent or got his parents to spend the $30 and had the public beta and would just tell us about it.
More rumors.
Yeah.
Well, it wasn't too much of a wait after the public beta for the official release of macOS 10, where we then at least had a shot of being able to use it.
That's right.
So the official release was March 24th of 2001, it being no longer a beta, and it being the time when operating systems cost money and were not bundled with hardware, it was released for $129, a price which I think was the going rate for major versions of macOS 10 for some years after that.
I think so. I think until, what's the famous, Snow Leopard was like the famous fix one, so that lowered the price, and then...
And then Lion was the first that was all digital distribution, unless you asked pretty, pretty please, can I have a thumb drive with it?
Thinking back to this release in hindsight, again, this is 2001, so the G4 is out, and the iMac G3 has been out for a couple years. So the requirements for this, again, not just like it's a forward thinking operating system, but it's also graphically intensive just to do everyday operations within the Finder. It was kind of a hard stop for the PowerPC pre G3 era. And that made sense to me as I was going back looking at stuff for this episode. But there's a curious thing on the Internet Archive's cached version of the Apple Store listing for macOS 10, 10.0, that says requirements G3 or higher, except the original PowerBook G3. And I'm sure there's a reason for that that is just eluding me. Other than that, your other requirements were 128 megs of RAM, which was definitely above any of the computers we had in our house in 2001, and 1.5 gigs of free disk space. And I think the minimum install was around half that, which again was also kind of at a premium in our house. So it wasn't until the next machine my family bought that came with OS X pre-installed. Did I ever get to encounter it?
Yeah, same for me, because we also had a G3 in the house, but it was a beige G3. And yeah, if the operating system required 1.5 gigabytes of disk space, I believe we had a 4 gigabyte disk in that machine. So that was going to be a bit of an ask, especially because you pretty much needed to keep around Mac OS 9, which we'll get to. So this was all additive. You really needed to have that free or be starting from a completely empty configuration to get by with just the minimum. And looking up that first PowerBook G3, it looks like it only had a 250 megahertz G3 processor, and maybe the RAM wasn't there. Its maximum memory was 160 megabytes. So probably most of those machines just didn't have the RAM footprint for unless you had really souped it up.
And here on the show, we've done an episode about Apple's use of the Roman numeral 10 and X. We've done episodes about physical retail software packaging. All of these things kind of come together in the shelf presence of Mac OS X. It's a big aqua blue Garamond X that kind of kept hidden its code name, which only, you know, 2 point releases later was the main marketing focus of Mac OS X. Because as we all know, if you're listening to this podcast, the code names for the first many versions of Mac OS X followed a pattern.
Yeah, they were all big cats, starting with Cheetah being 10.0. And that was the first of the big cats. There were a couple of code names in the developer previews. Or it was either the last developer preview or the public beta was Kodiak, which is a bear, not a cat. But yeah, 10.0 established the first as a big cat, and then Puma was hot on its heels.
That's right, which we'll get to as well.
So here it is. It's March of 2001. You have a machine that runs Mac OS X, and you get it installed. What's new? What is so radically different from the classic Mac OS? And the answer is pretty much everything.
Like we've covered in our next transition episode, the actual, like, the code lying underneath everything that you see, everything from the floor up was different. Mac OS X was built on a new kernel, and I'm kind of punching above my weight in just trying to recite all these things, but the key word for the foundation of Mac OS X is Darwin, and I have a note here because I just finished listening right before we recorded. One of the recent episodes of the Accidental Tech podcast had a user-submitted question, is Mac OS X still the foundation of iOS? Because that was a selling point in the original iPhone keynote. And in a manner of speaking, yes, all of Apple's operating systems still run Darwin at their core.
Yeah, and the mock kernel.
Yes, right. Which, of course, relies on Unix technologies instead of all the mess that was the crash-prone classic Mac OS.
Right, and this was the huge conversation coming up to how is Apple going to make a next-generation operating system. The first attempt was to do it in-house. The second attempts looked seriously at the B infrastructure or the Windows NT kernel. And what they landed on was the BSD mock kernel, which came out of the Unix tradition of open software and a long pedigree in academia, Bell Labs, those kinds of things. So usually the fact that you're running something called Darwin, that was the code that was running your operating system, would be completely opaque and users wouldn't really care about it the same way that they didn't care about what was the low level foundation of classic Mac OS, other than that they hoped that it worked. Yeah. But one of the things of bringing over the Unix tradition was the introduction of the terminal app, which I think was a huge cultural shift for Mac users who were extremely used to everything being a GUI. And the notion of a command line, especially in consumer computing applications, reeked of DOS and the other side that, to totally misappropriate a Steve Jobs quote, if you see a command line, they got it wrong.
Yeah. The original Macintosh running version one of the original Macintosh system software was a rebuke to the established command line based interfaces of other computing platforms. That's why it was the computer for the rest of us. And so Mac OS X kind of brought it full circle.
Coming along with that were some of the things that, like, if you started up in single user mode by pressing a key command, I think it was command S at startup, instead of getting a Happy Mac or even a pleasing gray Apple logo, you would just immediately dump into this thing that looked like a Windows PC starting up and telling you, you know, how many blocks of RAM it had, that kind of thing. And it was very off-putting to many people, especially the notion that you might be expected or needed to rely on the terminal for some functions of your operating system.
Right. Like, some of the knowledge base articles, I'm sure, from this era, from this transitional era, probably had to guide end users through that process of running, what's the famous one, like FSCK commands in single user mode. And that's a lot to ask someone to just, you know, follow a K-base article while they're in kind of a high stress situation, but to do so and have some unfamiliar looking computer environment while you're doing it, you feel like you're breaking it even further.
Oh, yeah. There was something just within the last year where there was some bizarre issue where Apple put out instructions where they're like, boot into recovery mode. Then in recovery mode, you can go to Safari. So before you do that, write down the website.
Oh, God.
Write down this URL so you can come back to this webpage in recovery mode and copy out a paragraph of stuff to paste into the terminal to fix your computer. It's like, this is not the experience that Apple ever wanted.
No, that sounds awful.
And people were afraid that that was the kind of thing that would become the norm. This is like a horrible edge case and people still make fun of it today. But just the fact that it was there felt like it was putting the toe in the door towards something bad. And, you know, I think that as we've come to love Mac OS X over two decades, some people get by with never opening the terminal at all. And some people know that it's there and that it's, you know, a little bit of a magic spell that they can invoke at certain times, especially if they have someone guiding them along. I mean, heck, Mac OS X hints made an entire living off of one-line terminal commands, pretty much built an empire. on the fact that there were these, you know, extra little secret things that you could do if you knew how this worked. And then, of course, there was a whole host of people who had experienced Unix in, you know, in production environments or in academia or in research. And they're like, oh, this is familiar. These are, you know, the Dr. Drangs of the world, who still get most of their work done on a Mac by typing 2- and 3-letter commands into Unix prompt. And it works great for them. So it was a little scary at first, but it turned out to definitely be a positive aspect of the new Mac OS.
And of course, like we've already alluded to, if there were a two-sided coin of what's new in Mac OS X, one is the scary terminal-laden world of the Unix base and Darwin. And the flip side of that is the bright and beautiful, visually pleasing world of the Aqua user interface and the Quartz graphics subsystem. I think, like has been mentioned already, classic macOS had PostScript and Display PostScript, and Quartz was a leap beyond to the extent that your graphics computing power would be taxed doing things like rendering potentially infinite levels of translucency if you just kept opening windows and tiling them over each other and activating one or not activating the other, shadows, rippling looking effects as progress bars filled up, pulsating blue buttons. Like, the interface was alive and just, you know, like recreating bitmap for bitmap this interface on the old OS wouldn't have worked. Another thing about Quartz was it kind of brought PDF and being able to scale and vectorize a lot of elements came to it. So now we have print to PDF in Mac OS X. It kind of paved the way for Retina Max to show up much, much later, or high DPI mode as Cable Sasser was kind of hunting down before Retina became a thing.
Yeah, in 2021, probably the most used feature that came out of adding in the Quartz layer is the individual rendering of windows, which I didn't fully appreciate for several years into Mac OS X. But now everyone who on a Zoom call needs to share one window and then realizes that even if you put other windows in front of that window, just its contents, as if it were really truly a piece of paper that you could slide out from all of the other ones and see it all at once, it gets rendered out to your video stream for other people to see. And that all comes back to this Quartz underpinnings of how the windows were being rendered. And it's great. They've sorted out all the bugs and it's optimized now. But I recall that there was also, it was like sort of a myth and sort of a reality that in early Mac OS X, that you could literally slow down your computer by having more icons on the desktop. Because effectively a bug, it treated each icon on the desktop like a window, like a separate layer. And so if you had 100 files on your desktop, it was the same as having 100 windows open.
Oh my God.
And asking your poor little grinding G3 with a spinning hard drive to render all of that all of the time in the background, even when you weren't looking at it.
Speaking of icons, like you just did, that's a nice transition to another part of the Aqua interface that made it feel substantially different from the Platinum interface of the outgoing Classic OS. I think we've had episodes about icons and the icon community, and we were kind of confined to that 32 by 32 pixel grid for so long. And the biggest advance there was the leap to millions of colors and translucency in the masking. But the leap to the gigantic icons and the human interface guideline recommended style for those icons was, I think, even bigger.
Definitely. And this was an area that also had some growing pains. It was pretty obvious in the developer previews that icons were a bit of an afterthought. And the way that the icon formats had developed in classic Mac OS was, it was very methodical. You started with a 32 by 32 grid of black and white pixels, and then we added color, and then we added more colors and an alpha channel, but it was still operating in that very restricted 1024 pixel canvas. And then Mac OS X opened this up and said, oh, by the way, the default icon size is now 48 by 48. And everyone goes, okay, well, we can make pixel perfect things in that. And it's like, no, there's a slider.
Yeah.
And they can go up to 128 by 128. And everyone went, well, what the hell am I supposed to do with that? And Apple says, well, we don't really much know either. We just kind of pasted photos in here.
I was just going to say, a lot of the icons in the pre-release versions look like when I first started trying to make icons, and it would just copy and paste things into the Git info window and it would squish it down.
Yes, before you discovered ResEdit.
Yeah, exactly.
You made vector art in ClarisWorks and then just pasted it into Git info.
And, you know, it would squish it down. It would probably, I wouldn't have copied it in a perfect square ratio. So, you know, one dimension would be more squished than the other. And some of these things that made it out into these preview releases look a lot like that.
Yeah, there's one where there's a like an application icon, and it looks like they took, it's supposed to have a sort of uniform 3D perspective, the way that we think a good 3D icon should look. But instead, it looks like they just took the skew tool in Photoshop and just went in four different directions. It was flying off at a random angle.
Certainly when Mac OS X first came out, or maybe, you know, developer preview 3 when Aqua first came out, and then with every major like resolution breakthrough, someone will do the thing like, here is like a standard icon in Mac OS X, put it a native resolution of the original shipping Macintosh, which was 512 pixels across, and it's the whole screen, or it's like beyond the entire screen.
Or you can put the entire original Macintosh screen between the icons on an iPad Pro. So there was a lot of room to play with there. You know, in one respect, it was interesting. I think in hindsight, we can see it as one of Apple's first big steps in wanting to take control of user interface was the fact that they almost said, these new Aqua icons that we made are so good that you won't really need to customize your icons anymore. You're not going to want to paste things onto your folders to give them a different look. Just these blue folders forever are going to be all that you need. They're so great.
And another kind of interface paradigm associated with icons that has persisted to this day, and I think is a kind of a big part of our lives, whether we think about them or not, or you know, try not to think about them, is the red notification bubble on an application icon. I think, you know, in the classic Mac OS, when you opened an application and it was actively running, the icon kind of got filled out. I forget. What's a great way to describe this?
Yeah, there was the outline of the icon, and then it turned that like weird purple texture.
Yeah. And so like you weren't meant to, obviously there wasn't a dock, but you weren't meant to refer back to that application's icon as any kind of status. If something, if an alert popped up and it needed your attention, I think the most intrusive it got was flashing the application who needed your attention's 16 by 16 icon in the application menu at the upper right of your screen. There were no such thing as these notification bubbles, let alone kind of the growl style notifications that later would be baked into the OS.
Right. But there was the precursor of this was in the Mail app, right? Where
yeah,
it actually showed the number of unread items in your inbox. As I think the Overcast settings now say, to add stress to your life.
Exactly. The Mail.app that shipped with Mac OS X, I think, is the first, certainly the first like widely known mass adopted application to use this notification bubble number style.
Was it a straight circle, or did it have the little starburst like a sticker?
It was a little starburst, because we're in like web 2.0 era with everything's on a shiny table and there's just a little bit extra bit of design on everything that we're doing.
Yeah, so eventually that got smoothed out to the red circle, which then got iconified even more. I mean, like, heck, I look down at my watch and there's just a little red dot at the top. It doesn't even have a number in it, but it means there's a notification waiting for you.
Mm-hmm.
Other things that were added that swept away beloved interface of the past and introduced new pieces of iconography that are known universally, even to non-Mac users, out with the watch cursor whenever you were waiting for something, and in with the infamous spinning beach ball, which is not really a beach ball.
It's true.
It's just round and has a rainbow spiral on it, but it became known as the beach ball and like entered the lexicon. You know, your computer can beach ball, which means that it is stuck doing something and you are unable to fix it. And I'm sure that that has crept out beyond just the people who use Mac OS X to mean that same kind of thing. Being in a state where no further processing can happen. I am busy. But I remember when they said that, like, no, there's not going to be a watch cursor. And it felt like a betrayal.
Right, yeah.
You know, that was one of the things of classic Mac OS, was that you're almost always looking at the pointer, which was black with a white outline, which was correct, unlike Windows, which was white with a black outline and was wrong.
And like the geometry of the pointer doesn't make sense either. That's a whole nother thing.
Yeah. And then if you were waiting for something in Mac OS, it was the very tasteful little watch where it just spun around and around and around. Whereas in Windows, there was an hourglass, which was like, okay, I see what you did there. You didn't want to get sued by having a watch. So to eliminate it, it felt like, what do you mean? That's waiting for things and staring at a watch cursor is a key part of using the Mac. But no, they thought that the beach ball was more whimsical. And it became a huge part of using Mac OS X because there was frequently a lot of waiting.
Yeah.
Fortunately, now it's a bit less common.
And it's been flattened, of course.
Oh, well, yeah. Yeah. Now it's literally just a rainbow pinwheel. One of the other interesting new Aqua interface elements was the introduction of sheets. Again, going to that notion of every window being independent, apps being totally independent, a new multitasking paradigm. So instead of having a dialog box that is going to get in the way of everything, or a modal dialog that's just another window that can get lost in the shuffle, instead introduce this concept of what if we took those things like, hey, do you want to save this or not save it or cancel, and actually attach it to the document that it went to. That would make a ton of sense. You would visually see that that this goes with that window. It's been 20 years and sheets can sometimes still be confusing. The ones that were one-to-one replacements of very typical dialog boxes made sense, but the sheet has been repurposed and reused in so many bad places that it's hard to say that it's a total net win over time. We've gone into the weeds here on Aqua and skipped over one of the things that's staring you in the face when you open up a default installation of Mac OS. And it's this thing that's not the menu bar and not the desktop.
It's the dock, of course.
We've become blind to it at this point.
Yeah, it's a standard.
It's part of the furniture.
I was just talking about the application menu, which I think maybe as of Mac OS 9 or maybe 8.6, you could kind of tear off and have an application switcher representing your open applications, which is maybe the closest thing before Mac OS 10 to a dock. But this was a permanent thing. By default, anchored to the bottom of your screen, but you know the true pros will move it to the left or the right. That not only had your currently running applications, but would have shortcuts to commonly used applications, maybe taking the place of the launcher in classic Mac OS, or even all the way back to like a very, very rudimentary version of something like At Ease. And of course, it carried with it not just the functionality and the utility, but the Aqua-y goodness. So it's got its own distinct style that I think in 10.0 had very subtle pinstripes running through its translucent background, the trash can rendered in new modern beauty as opposed to the kind of dingy takeout to the curb trash can that Oscar the Grouch lived in. And at I think at 10.0, the dock lits, where they're kind of like the menu bar extras that you could control airport strength and monitor resolution from your dock instead of your menu bar.
Put a big analog clock in there.
Yeah, that's right. Just so many things. That was another way to get around your Mac.
And it was kind of home base for gratuitous animations. Of course, when you did the genie effect, things went into and out of the dock. And then also the fact that when you hovered over icons in the dock, they magnified.
Oh, that's right.
Quite reasonably dramatically by default. And if you went into the settings, you could make it ludicrous. Showing off the full size of those huge icons.
And of course, they would bounce when they were opening, which took the place of the zooming rectangles coming out at you from the icon, a different style of opening animation. Yeah, the dock, man. It's just taken for granted now.
Do you use dock magnification at all?
No, I have it hidden and it's on my right edge.
Oh, okay. I think I'm the last power user who uses any dock magnification. And I have it set at like 1 pixel higher than the icon size, just so that if I hover over the dock, I have some indication of whether it has crashed entirely. Like if things are going really wrong and some process has just totally gummed up your Mac, even today, like the dock will quit. Like it'll just be like, no, I can't magnify anymore. And you're like, oh, okay, I see what's going on here.
That's a good test. My test for that in the classic macOS days was to have flashing seconds in the menu bar clock.
Oh, yeah.
And once those stopped, then you're like, oh, okay. So that's like an overview of the overall interface, but there were some specific tweaks to the way that the home base environment of your Mac felt and operated. And that's, of course, Finder. Now, I guess, Finder.app, the Macintosh. Oh, what does it say? The Macintosh browsing experience?
The Macintosh desktop experience.
Yeah, there you go. The first thing that I remember being like a disorienting change is that in classic macOS, whenever you double-clicked on a folder, it opened a new Finder window showing the contents of that folder. And if you closed that window, it might zoom back into the icon in the preceding window. But the behavior, at least the default behavior of macOS 10, is there's really like one Finder window that you do your file navigation and essentially your browsing in, which was the model for Windows 95 and Windows 98, which by that time I was using at school. And so that's why it was disorienting to me, because it felt like a Windows machine, not just un-Mac-like, but specifically Windows, like Windows Explorer. And I hated it at first.
Me too. And I still hate it. And I aggressively turn off the toolbar on Finder Windows so it doesn't do that. But I think that the real answer was that it was yet another Nextism, because Next didn't use the forward and backward like a web browser interface as its primary. They said, no, we are sophisticates, and we have determined that the ideal way for navigating your file hierarchy is in column view, where you have one window that's split into multiple columns with the higher levels at the left, drilling down into the lower levels at the right. And naturally, that's all contained within one window. And I also rejected that in the early days of OS X, saw column view and went, what is this here for? This is stupid. I finally grew to love column view only 5 or 6 years ago, when I was working at a job where almost all of the files that we had to work on were stored on a network share that was accessed via SMB. And it was not particularly responsive, and especially when loading up folders that had hundreds or thousands of items in them. And if you went with the old style navigation of like, hey, I'll open up a new window for everything, you would get into this sort of weird hanging state, and the Finder really hated it. Like, it would just be like, oh no, like, we're stuck here doing network access. But if you went into, or if you had drilled down and then wanted to go back up, it's like, well, gotta re-access all the things at the higher levels.
Yeah.
But if you did it in the column view, you had access to everything that you had drilled down to and everything above it in a less laggy interface. And again, probably exactly the motivation for Next developing that kind of system was they were doing things on a server and client approach. Steve Jobs, when he came, I think it wasn't it like the 97 WWDC Q&A where, or shortly thereafter, where he's like, wouldn't it be great if you could just sit down at any Mac and your files are just on a server somewhere and you just access them over the network? So that was kind of, that's how I think that interface got started, and then still lives on in OS X.
And one thing about that column view is, you know, if you're using it to page up and down folders in a hierarchy, once you selected one in your current column, the column to the right would open up with the contents of the selected folder, of course. But if the thing that you were selecting in your currently focused column was a discrete file, what would they show in the column to the right of it? Obviously, it doesn't contain anything. Although I guess if it's an app bundle, gosh, something else we'll get to. it is a directory. But if it was an image file or a QuickTime file, what would that right column show? It would do some of the work of GitInfo, which did carry over from classic Mac to macOS 10. But it was kind of a precursor to QuickLook, which now is another thing I take for granted, that I don't have to open an application to see the contents of a file.
But that was revolutionary then. The notion that you could see into a file without using an application was wizardry.
Exactly. That's all I wanted to say, is that like that was the thing that sold me on Column View, is it kind of unlocked this secret power.
When you were navigating around in Column View, you might decide that you actually wanted to get to places quickly. And one of the ways that you could do that was you could drag things up into the toolbar, a customizable toolbar in Finder Windows that, again, made it feel a bit web browsery. Because I think at that point, things like Internet Explorer 5
yep.
was like the only app that I had ever customized a toolbar in that way before. And this was saying, no, this is a first class experience on the Mac, and the Finder supports it. You can right click on this toolbar and edit the items in it. And then the same thing in many of the other first party apps like Mail and TextEdit. And then it was made clear to developers that also you should offer these customizable toolbars in your apps.
Mm-hmm.
That covers the functionality of the Finder windows. Then there are the things that you might find within them. Like this extremely strange folder with your name on it.
Right, with the icon of a house. And I don't want this. Also, there's something that's called library. Well, ebooks don't exist yet. I don't want this either. I want to throw all these things away.
The greatest mistake they made in these early versions, back with the iconography, is the fact if they just called it library and gave it a plain blue folder icon, people might have not done anything with it. Even better would have been if they took one of the little like classic Happy Mac kind of, or you know, Mac outline icons and put that on there. Then people would be like, oh, that's a system folder kind of thing, right?
It's blessed.
But instead they put pictures of leather bound books on it, which was a huge mistake. Yes, leading to the infamous stories of Merlin Mann deleting his library folder. I never made that mistake. I read in a magazine what the library was for and that you should mostly just leave it be. But again, this felt sort of a Windowsy thing that that there would be folders with names where you were expected to put things, as opposed to the previous Mac way was that you had a disk and at the root level of the disk, you put whatever you wanted. The only thing that you had to put in a specific place was if that was your startup disk, the system folder had to be at the root level of the startup disk.
And specifically, if there were ways you wanted to customize the way that your system looked and behaved for you, because with the, you know, kind of bad exception of Mac OS 9 multiple users, a Mac was a single user device. So if you were assumed to be the only person using it, or if you were making the decisions, everyone else using it would live with it. So if you wanted to, you know, do things to make the Mac your Mac, you would do it, like Ed said, at the root level, in the system folder or wherever. But a lot of those things, there was a system folder at the root level of a Mac OS X hard disk, but you couldn't mess with it. You had to do all that tinkering and stuff.
Well, I mean, you could back then, but...
you shouldn't have.
To your detriment. This was one of the things in the classic Mac OS, the only place that applications could count on there being certain places for things was in the system folder, which of course led to getting totally gummed up in your system folder by apps putting stuff there willy-nilly.
Abuse.
abuse of the system. But then the fact that in Mac OS X you had folders like pictures and documents and music that apps knew would always be there led to similar abuse, especially of the documents folder,
mm-hmm.
to the point that I think starting in about 10.3, when I first had my own Mac running Mac OS X, I tried to put my things in the documents folder because I figured, well, yeah, that makes sense. I'm okay to try out this organizational system. But so much junk would get automatically put there by other apps that I couldn't even find my own stuff. And so for literally over 10 years, I had a folder in my home directory that was called Real Documents. And to this day, I occasionally find myself invoking Launch Bar and typing RD. As like that's where everything lives,
mm-hmm.
Because this like dark pattern made me go to this other folder. I think that now in the sandboxing era, for one, and just because people realized that it was a bad look, there are only a couple of applications that do that. And for those, I've created Hazel rules that immediately throw those things in the trash.
Nice.
So I can live out of /users/ed/documents.
So those were a lot of things that were brand new in macOS 10 and became the way that using a Mac would be for the following 20 years.
A whole lot of adjusting to do.
A lot. And some of it was an update or a refresh of things that we were used to. Some of them were brand new things that were kind of built on top. But of course, there's another element to it of some things, some apps, some interfaces, some behaviors from the classic macOS were just done away with, a little bit of a fresh slate.
Right, because people came to this and said, okay, Steve Jobs, you've told us what the new version of macOS is going to look like. I'm already running something called macOS. It's been called that since 7.5.3. So obviously all my apps are going to run on this because apps cost hundreds of dollars.
Yeah.
And I am not made of money. I'm going to give you $130 for this operating system that will run all of my old apps, to which Apple said, yes, big asterisk.
So again, this is a little bit punching above at least my understanding, but when you talk about the APIs and the software development kit for writing these apps, writing third parties writing software for the Mac, you know, it's a nebulous process to begin with, but it was even more so before macOS 10. What did you have to like?
MetroWorks Code Warrior.
That's right.
And Mac Pascal before that.
That's right. That's right. And they would follow, you know, they would write in, I don't even know, Pascal, obviously C, C++. And then there was a new set of APIs to work with the new Unix-based operating system called Cocoa. You know, that's the forward thinking. That's the new normal. That's the new base. Apple said, we will make another set of APIs that's kind of cross-platform, kind of a little bit of classic macOS, kind of a little bit of Cocoa forward-thinking OS that should be easy, you know, asterisk, asterisk, for developers to update their existing applications so that to use these new APIs so that they can exist in this transitional period on both. And that was the Carbon APIs.
This was the first attempt at, we've thrown out all of the new things and all you have to do as a developer is just click recompile in Xcode. Unfortunately, it took them another decade or so for that to become anywhere near reality.
I remembered all like Carbon environment and Carbon related system extensions that all of a sudden popped up when I updated macOS 9 to like 9.0.4 on my machine that was stuck in the past at home. And I'm like, what is this stuff? And thankfully I didn't get into a trash your library thing because I think it would have had a similar result. But I think it for all the, you know, the stuff we just said, it was kind of a smart thing because, like me still only existing on macOS 9 could update apps, third-party apps that I use that would start to run on Carbon APIs. And it would be pretty much transparent to me, the end user stuck on macOS 9, even though this was now kind of a cross-platformy app. So for all the kind of jankiness that it may look like on paper, I think it worked pretty well.
Sure, but even that system required some work on the part of developers. And obviously, there are always apps that are critical to people's workflows or just their happiness that are not being actively maintained. Or even if they are being actively maintained, the developer has limited resources and time. And these things are not as instantaneous as Apple would hope. So what about those apps? Well, if you really, absolutely, desperately needed some apps that would only run in the old ways of classic macOS, the first piece of advice was just boot into classic macOS.
Right. If you had a machine that could bridge that gap.
And that's how it was at the initial launch. Every machine could run both classic and macOS 10. And it was really recommended that you didn't just blow away your installation of macOS 9 the day that you installed macOS 10, or you would be sad. For one, because it was required if you took the other path, which was to run your app in classic mode, where we get the name Classic macOS, in a sense. And if you launched an app in classic mode, a little thin aqua window appeared at the top of your screen with a progress bar that said that the classic environment was starting. And there was a disclosure triangle. I think modern Apple would not include the disclosure triangle, because if you clicked the disclosure triangle, it was revealed to you that what was happening was your Mac was starting a complete installation of macOS 9 with the extensions marching across the bottom of the screen in a window.
Yep.
So it wasn't emulation, right? Because macOS 9 was native on these machines, but it meant that in an era where you still sometimes in classic macOS had to go to the get info window and adjust the memory allocation of yeah. apps to make them work, you are now running two full operating systems on that machine, including the new one, which was very hungry about being able to draw its lickable icons.
That's right.
I mean, the one great trick of that was that you saw the startup process in a window. And then you might think, okay, so then you're just running macOS 9 in a window. Everything has to fit within those bounds. But no, as soon as it got to the OS 9 desktop, the window went away, was hidden. And then when that app then got the chance to finally launch, all of its windows lived interleaved with the macOS 10 windows, but they were still platinum, 100%, all mixed in with the shiny new Aqua. And it was not a good-looking experience.
Their 32 by 32 pixel icons were upscaled to match whatever size your dock was, including magnification. And so you got a lot of jaggies in there.
But I definitely remember doing this. I mean, I think for a couple years of... Well, I don't know if it was a couple years of us being cheap or just complete lack of availability. But, you know, we ran on ClarisWorks, right?
Mm-hmm.
Later, AppleWorks.
Right.
And then AppleWorks did go Carbon so that you could launch it natively in OS 10. But there was a while there where no, it was opening up Classic for basically all of the files that I had.
I mentioned Claris homepage earlier, and when I was dabbling on HTML based static sites in college, I was still, when I needed to kind of fudge it with a WYSIWYG, I would still boot Classic and then boot like version 3 of Claris homepage from 1996. To help me through it.
So there was that way to, if you had to run all of your old applications, it may be not the best experience, but that not all software is applications, right? So there were things that were just completely cut off. Of course, anything that lived in the old system folder, again, were key pieces of software in the classic era, extensions and control panels. Everyone knows that you absolutely need tilde ATM in your extensions folder
right.
to make the fonts render properly in Adobe apps. And you may have had control panels that you loved to use because they brought certain functionality to your machine. Or, you know, some of the wild things like Kaleidoscope, right?
Yeah.
There were no hooks for that into the underpinnings of macOS 10, and so they were all just completely out. And of course, developers soon learned that there were these things called kernel extensions, and that you could do good or evil with them.
Right.
And that there were ways of significantly customizing this new protected, memory protected architecture in the new operating system. But a lot of the flexibility that people thought of as inherent to macOS went away with the elimination of those two key areas in the system folder. Another thing that lived in the system folder was really just a harmless little folder full of aliases. It was called Apple Menu Items. Apple saw the error of their ways of just putting an Apple logo in the middle of the menu bar where it got in the way of things, especially on laptops from Developer Preview 3. But when they put the Apple menu back in its rightful place, they didn't restore its functionality. It basically took over the functions of what used to be the special menu in the Finder,
right? Yeah.
Which went away. Things like shutting down your Mac, or now in OS X, logging out of your user account. It retained some of the things like recent items that used to be a feature of the Apple menu. Again, just made up with aliases, though.
Yeah.
In classic macOS. But there was no place. People really relied on the Apple menu as their hub of all activity. And the answer was, well, put it in the dock. And now that I think of it, that's a totally valid replacement for that functionality. But I think just, you know, people hate change, and just the fact that it was in a different place in the screen, it was enough. I mean, one of the big Apple menu hacks was, oh, just put an alias of your hard drive.
Exactly.
There. And then once we had hierarchical menus starting in Mac OS 8, you could just drill down all these levels in a menu with a mouse. Well, in current Mac OS, you can put an alias of your hard drive in the dock and say view as list, and it gives you hierarchical menus. It does. It's all still there.
Yeah.
But it was another one of those things where a seemingly minor change and really not that much removal of functionality felt like a piece of culture was taken away rather than just a feature was moved.
It's especially to that culture point, the Apple menu in classic macOS was the six color Apple that we know and love from that era. And I think more because the corporate Apple logo and the logo on its hardware was moving to monochrome, whether it was, you know, like a black or a white for printing purposes or reflecting the color of the iMac that you had bought. The macOS 10 Apple menu was always a single tone and now has been reduced to being just monochrome.
Yeah. Do you remember that it was sort of the late Aqua period where the primary Apple logo was graphite with a little swoop through it?
Yes. Yeah.
That was a weird time.
It was a shiny aluminum, right? The beginning of Johnny Ive's aluminium and glass.
Oh, yeah. Let's see. What else were we missing at launch? All your, you know, your classic, I said, okay, like your classic apps will launch. You'll have to boot up that classic environment. You say, ah, okay, well, good. At least I can still do half of the things that I do with my Mac because I will have ResEdit. To which macOS 10 said, no, you will not, because files no longer have resource forks.
And this was sad. This was definitely sad because this was the way, Ed, certainly you and I grew up, you know, tinkering with the Mac and the way that it unlocked the creativity part of your brain, the bicycle for the mind type stuff. And that hurt, right? Like you could not only just customize your system, but with resource forks, like that's how you made escape velocity plugins. And that's how you could customize pretty much anything graphically or the sound component. If you were okay with the code and the way that the application ran, you could almost certainly open it up with ResEdit and tinker the way it felt and looked and sounded. And that went away with the disappearance of resource forks in the Unix-based system.
And we know that ResEdit was a very sharp knife, right? And you could cut yourself.
Yeah.
if you didn't know what you were doing or if you were being uncareful. And the kind of replacement for that in Mac OS X is the terminal, right? I mean, part of the reason that the terminal was scary was, I think, one of the first things that I learned about the terminal was in a Mac Addict article where they're like, what's the terminal? And then they had a list of like top 10 things you should never type into the terminal, culminating in rm-rf/. It was like, oh, this is potential danger here, but also a potential huge benefit. But the incantations of the terminal are hard to learn, or you have to go to macOS 10 hints and be like, here's a one-liner for the thing that you wanted to do because someone discovered it, as opposed to ResEdit, that because the GUI of ResEdit was so good, you could go in and be like, oh, these are all the things that are in this application. Oh, like they're in categories and some of them are just little zeros and ones, but some of them have icons. So I can intuit what is going on here. And that was gone.
It was a couple years after using macOS 10 full-time for me, where I realized that right-clicking on an application and doing show package contents did reveal after one or two levels that there's a resources folder, which was somewhat like the resource fork of an application in the old days, in that if the app was constructed that way and not heavily reliant on kind of proprietary storyboards or, heaven forbid, some kind of bundled library, you could kind of swap out some sound effects, which were usually like AIFFs or waves, or you could swap out some PNG or PDF resources and get back to it. But Ed, like you were saying, ResEdit gave you a GUI to step through it in a way that felt intuitive. And this is just a hair above doing commands in the terminal when you're just swapping out literal files for each other.
Right. And I got the impression very quickly in the early OS 10 days that, yeah, you can go in there, but that's like a read-only zone. And that actually changing the things in app bundles could lead to serious problems. More so like with less flexibility than in ResEdit. Like if you gave something the same resource ID in ResEdit, like unless you replaced like a 2 kilobyte sound with a 400 kilobyte sound and you crashed the app,
yeah,
like pretty much anything was possible. And now today you can still view the contents of an app, but it's literally like you will break it if you change anything in there because everything is cryptographically signed.
Oh, that's right.
So yeah, ResEdit was a big loss. Although I've opened up ResEdit in emulation sometimes recently and gone, wow, like I was really doing like half of the things on my Mac with this app,
mm-hmm.
but I do a broader range of things now. I just had to take a long time to learn new tools and new paradigms.
We were growing with the Mac.
So I think that covers lots of things that were added at the beginning, lots of things that were gone and required various length periods of adjustment to get used to their absence and come up with equal or better replacements, or sometimes just not. But that was only the beginning of the OS X story. We've had two whole decades that have intervened. So to finish off the episode, I think we should do our traditional whirlwind chronology and say, what are the things that that were not part of the original Mac OS X that by now we may even take for granted? And at what point did they come along?
And this first bullet point that you have in here made me laugh when I got to it.
So, right, when we were compiling the outline for this show, Brian had put a bunch of like capitalized app names and features and stuff in this list, along with the versions that they started at. And you started at 10.2.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, no, we have to have 10.1 in here. And the thing that was missing before 10.1 was performance. So we talked about how when macOS 10.0 was released, it was a $130 operating system, and that many of the versions that followed were also $130. Well, not macOS 10.1.
Yeah.
It was rather quickly released, and it was a mere $30 to cover, you know, shrink wrapping a DVD and all that, because Apple wanted it in the hands of as many customers as possible because they wanted Mac OS X to not be bad anymore.
Hot fix.
Right. Yeah, this is the kind of thing where if these were the bugs that you were dealing with now, you would just get a push notification that's like, please, please run this. If you don't actively opt out of this, I will do this while you sleep. But it cleared up a lot of those initial things. And I think there were a couple interface tweaks too. It was either from the developer preview to 10.0, but I think it might have been 10.0 to 10.1, where they made it so that you could actually read the title bars in inactive windows again.
Yeah, that's something that John Siracusa would cover in his lengthy reviews of every major release, or even people like Stephen Hackett has his Brushed Metal anthology, I think. John Gruber has stuff on Brushed Metal. The way that the pinstripes and the colored clear glass and brushed metal moving to unified slabs of gray progressed over the entire run of Mac OS X is something I don't think we even want to get into.
We'll link to Steven's archive of the screenshot archive of every major version of macOS that's still current and that he still spends a great amount of time on every year and is really invaluable to anyone who wants to see the history of this.
But getting back to features that we take for granted as baked into the macOS today, Safari, a first-party web browser, didn't come along until Jaguar, macOS 10.2. And the same goes for a chat client, which today is Messages, but at launch in 10.2 was iChat, and it was really interfacing with AIM.
But Safari, I think, is I mean, that's the big one. I was listening to some podcasts the other day, and they were talking about, well, when did Safari launch? And they're going, 2003. I know, it's 2003, right? Like, that fact is in my brain. But then when we were putting this together and going, well, it's been 20 years, 2001, like, it, I didn't put those two facts together, that I know that OS X was released in 2001 and Safari was released 2 years later. It's like, well, what did we do for that time? The answer was largely Internet Explorer.
Yep, that big glossy aqua E in your dock.
Super stripey.
Yeah.
And it had the different themes where it matched the colors of IMAX or graphite if you wanted to be pro.
The weirdest thing going back and looking at the first version of Safari for me is the orange back arrow in the URL field or the separate Google field, which Apple gave the marketing name of the camel cased snapback, because it seemed like that was going to change browsing. Is that, like, if you go down your Wikipedia rabbit hole and you want to get back to the first page you looked at in this window, because back then there weren't even tabs, it would always give you a way back to, like, the first page with snapback instead of just, like, long pressing on the back button and going through the menu. They dedicated, like, time to that in the keynote. It was camel cased and in the press release. What happened to snapback? Oh, it wasn't that important of a thing.
I forgot about it entirely.
Yeah, exactly.
But yeah, the fact that, you know, this was a major modern rethinking of the operating system, and that didn't even include a web browser. That was kind of fast. I mean, maybe in one respect, that would have been the wrong time to launch a web browser with your operating system. This was right around the time that Microsoft was going through big antitrust problems around Internet Explorer and it being so hooked into the Windows operating system and not being able to get rid of it and being hard to have alternatives. So Apple may have been a little bit leery of that. But in the 2020s, the notion of shipping an operating system without a web browser, it's like shipping a car without seats. Yeah. Right? Like, I mean, technically you can bring your own, but who wants to?
Right. We've actually gone the other way, where Chrome OS is a web browser that became the shipping operating system. That's how far we've come.
Right. And so it's so integral to everything that we do to have a first party web browsing option. And yeah, I think it's really good that we've also decided that people should have choice in terms of their web browser. But it's just absolutely critical in the way that's, you know, I found a video that we can link that was an official demo about 7 minutes long, about three of which is a movie trailer, but that's neither here nor there. I think it was for 10.1, maybe. So just, and it shows off the interface for, you know, connecting to the internet with a modem by opening up a particular system preference pane or a particular app that was like in the utilities folder. And so the notion of having a web browser was not as critical when there was the possibility that your Mac could be offline for large chunks of time. Whereas we know now that your Mac being offline is equals your Mac is broken. Like, didn't that happen just a few months ago where something in, like, the Gatekeeper servers broke and, like, every Mac around the world could not, like, you could not launch an app And it happened on my machine, then it happened on my parents' machine, and I'm getting calls from people like, are your apps breaking? It's like, what is this, the apocalypse?
We just can't reach the gatekeeper.
Right, but if you go into, like, I almost said airplane mode. Macs don't have airplane mode. But, like, but if you turn off Wi-Fi, then suddenly all your apps will launch. Because if you are actually offline, it's like, oh, you're in this strange situation. You must be on an airplane. That's the only place where nobody can get internet anymore.
We'll assume this app was good. It was good the last time we checked.
Yeah, we'll give you a pass on this one. You did mention also in 10.2 iChat, though, which was, let's say it, was an AOL Instant Messenger client.
100%.
Even though it had those, like, you know, other... different, like, was it Jabber?
Mm-hmm.
Which I think became the basis of Google Chat.
Oh, you're right.
Which nobody uses anymore.
Yeah, because it's gone through, well, Google's chatting ecosystem is famously a mess.
Yes. But Apple's is now famously a great credit to them because they decided to build iMessage into the iChat app and call it Messages then. And of course, then that natively works with iOS. And everyone knows that your blue bubbles are your friends and your green bubbles are your enemies. So quite a lot came out of the fact that Apple thought that, really interestingly, building an app for someone else's service, a first-party app for primarily for a third-party service or that relied on third-party services, because there was no iMessage back then, was an interesting choice. Not as obvious as Safari, right? You could sit in 2000 or 2001 and go, every computing device is going to need a web browser.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't so obvious that, like, desktop Macs would need a messaging app to be considered useful, or that would be one of Apple's, like, top pieces of IP 20 years later.
Just a fun little tie-in. The original icon for iChat was the AOL Instant Messenger, like, running yellow man.
Yeah, it must have been. There must have been an actual corporate partnership there.
But the yellow running man has a blue chat bubble. So even back then.
Oh, yeah. He's like holding it.
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
He's delivering it to someone.
Yeah, and it has an exclamation point in it. Here's your chat. Even back then, that was the standout thing. Blue bubbles.
Moving on to 10.3, an important utility that maybe not many Mac users actively use, but critical to many things that they do use, Xcode finally came on the scene in 10.3. There were precursors to it, of course, in those early days where Apple said, we've created Cocoa, and that we would love you to rewrite all your apps. They didn't just say, by magic.
I think, like, Interface Builder was a standalone app before Xcode and then got bundled into it.
Right. And Interface Builder, you know, had many, many years of Next heritage before that. But it was all about integrating the operating system tools with other IDEs. And this was the point where Apple said, if you want to be developing for our platform, you should really use our IDE. It's going to be the best for now, and soon the only place that you can really get all of this functionality for building Mac apps. And then, of course, fast forward 7-8 years down the line, the only place for building iOS apps. And it's kind of funny, again, anytime that I hear someone say, well, does Apple really care about the Mac? What if they just, like, let it fade away? And you just look at them and go, then where would the iOS apps come from? Every single one has to be written in Xcode, and it only runs in macOS.
And so some of these features that were added in point releases aren't surprises, right? Because some of them were the tentpole feature of that point release. A case in point is Time Machine in 10.5, where I think it's when we start to get the spacey sub theme.
Yeah, before we only had big cats. Now we have big cats in space.
Right. So I only wanted to highlight Time Machine as something that was added in at an OS level later on, because it replaced a different OS level backup thing that wasn't in 10.0 either. And this was the like often forgotten backup.app orangish red umbrella.
That was
tied to your whatever Apple was calling their online accounting system at the point. .Mac, Mobile Me, whatever. If you wanted to put some of your files, maybe from your cluttered documents folder, back it up online. That was kind of built in to subscribers of the cloud account, and then replaced, of course, by Time Machine.
I really wanted to use backup around that time. It was just before I actually got religion on backups, or maybe right around the time that I did. My last catastrophic hard drive failure was in 2008.
Ah, okay.
And so that was right before Time Machine, right around the time of Time Machine. And I think once I finally got up and running from that, it was right around when they had announced the Time Capsule, which was a hardware product that relied on the operating system feature of Time Machine to back up across the network. And I was like, screw it. I'm getting one of these. I'm never not being backed up again.
Yeah.
And yeah, what a incredibly useful feature to have built in. And one of the ones where I don't think that there are parallels necessarily on other platforms. Like if you're on Chrome OS, it's like, well, you have to just trust that the truth is in the cloud. And if you're on Windows, I don't think there's a really great full disk first party citizen backup solution. Not that I know of.
I think there's some kind of state restore more for debugging or solving problems that happen to your system installation and not really to like back up your content files. But I might be wrong about that.
Whereas, you know, recently I've helped people move from Windows PCs to Mac. And it's like, okay, and we're buying you a terabyte hard drive and we're hanging it off the back of your machine and we're turning on this thing called Time Machine. Don't worry about it, but it's happening.
In case of
just
fire.
Just leave that thing plugged in. Yeah. It's a laptop. When you come back to your desk, plug it in.
Yeah.
In case of fire, did you just say?
Yeah, I said, in case of fire, grab that thing. Grab everything.
But. Yeah. At my old job, there was not a universal backup solution, which was bad. So I bought a hard drive and backed up my work computer as well. And I kept the drive and filing cabinet at my office. And one day we had like a very unexpected fire drill. Like usually they would come around and announce like, hey, we're going to test it. And I like picked up the drive and I walked out. And one of my colleagues who was one of the more technically minded people in the office, he's like, so like all that stuff we have, if this is a real fire, like it's all gone, right? And I just like pulled a little drive out of my pocket. And he's like, you would.
That's like data Darwinism. Another big feature that was added this time in 10.6 was, of course, the App Store.
This is the one that's shocking to me on the timeline. Mac App Store, macOS 10.6. It feels like too low of a number, but it reminds me that earlier on in macOS 10, it was not on a yearly cadence. Things went up to like 2.5 years between the major releases. And so you say App Store, Mac App Store was 2009, right?
I think so, yeah.
Because it was iPhone 07, iOS App Store the next year, and then a year after that, Mac App Store. And so, like, I know where that is on the timeline, and just the version number feels a little bit weird.
Maybe what's contributing to that is that, sure, the Mac App Store launched with 10.6, but I think it was 10.8 where system updates were transferred from the System Preferences app to the Mac App Store. So maybe that's part of it, like, where the Mac App Store became all-encompassing for downloading software bits over the internet.
Yeah, that could be. With the Mac App Store, another part of the thing, part of why it's hard for me to wrap my brain around when it was and why 10.6 seems so early is because it hasn't really changed.
Right.
And there have been some recent conversations about, like, why is it so stagnant? What did Apple do wrong? Is it too late for them to change their mind on it? Those kinds of things. And it's a tough conversation. It feels like it should be a a big celebrated tentpole feature, but man, I'm way happier about many of the other things that we've listed existing, right? Like, I don't use Xcode. I don't even have it installed, but I'm thrilled that it's a part of the operating system, or at least like the first party suite of applications that go with it. And the Mac App Store is like, it's a place where I got some apps that was the only way to do it, and it fails at updating occasionally, and it mostly frustrates me.
I thought you might have been going down the policy side of the Mac App Store, and things like paid updates or better ways to try things out other than like the free trial leading into subscriptions. But yeah, just as an application running within the operating system, it's a bad application. Brent Simmons, who makes Net Newswire, I think is credited for popularizing the term a Mac-ass Mac app. Like, it doesn't feel like it's something that belongs on the Mac, let alone something that Apple made to run on the Mac. Like, there are back arrows that kind of override your history going between sections on the sidebar, and a button at the upper right that has the same function as a back arrow on the upper left. Like, it makes no sense.
Yeah, and then the other day I just, it said there are updates available, and I opened it up and I clicked on the updates tab, which said had a little six badge next to it, and it was just a white square. There's nothing there.
You can do Command R on that, even though I don't think it's a menu item, because everything is a web browser.
Oh, jeez.
That's a trick.
If only I knew.
This next item is the one for me that's like, how is this version number so high? And it's emoji, which didn't come baked into the macOS until 10.7.
I mean, emoji weren't official in iOS until iPhone OS 4, right?
Right. And even I think official might be stretching it, because there was that initial period where if you were in a Japanese localization or a Japanese install, they were part of your system keyboard, but you had to buy like a 99-cent unlocker app anywhere else in the world.
Yeah, I think that was in late iOS or iPhone OS 3 days. Yeah.
I definitely spent that 99 cents.
Right. But emoji are, table stakes feature, because people expect them to be part of the way that you can write on a computing device. And of course, now we know them as a major driver of upgrades.
That's right. We've all been on video conferencing, and I'm sure they're accompanied by some kind of slideshow presentation. And it is great when the emoji either look different or you just get the black square, because you're on some different version of Unicode or something, and it's just not cross-compatible. Like, we are still running into this where, like you said, emoji should be table stakes. Like, older versions of the OS should get updated for like the latest revision of Unicode and support it and get the fonts and everything. Like, it's table stakes. Come on.
I understand where they want to use it as the carrot to get people to actually upgrade the whole dang thing. My favorite implementation right now is Discord on the Mac. I think Discord uses the Twitter emoji set, the ones with the kind of square looking hands.
Okay. And they're open source.
And so they have that all within the app. And so you're always up to date. They always have the full set. But something strange about the way that they've coded the Mac client is that works in messages and reactions, but if someone puts an emoji in their username, it renders it using the system emoji. So they will at minimum look completely different, and at maximum, if you are running an older version of macOS, you'll get the blocks, boxes and squares and stuff.
Well, at least it's better than the early versions of the Slack desktop client, which I think had individual image files for each of, like, screenshots of Apple's emoji font that they were mapping.
That they just stole from Apple.
Yeah, and wouldn't update.
Yeah. Until Apple said, you realize that those are copyrighted and we will sue you.
Yeah.
We have one final major operating system feature on here. One of these underlying things that didn't come along until macOS 10.13, many, many years of hypercritical and accidental tech podcast later, the introduction of a new file system, ding, in APFS. Again, another thing that I am not enjoying the benefits of, because my poor sad iMac has a Fusion drive.
This might be the most technologically commendable thing, because as far as we know, nobody lost data, and in like upgrading from Sierra to High Sierra, if you had an SSD, just rewrote the file system on your boot hard disk silently and like pretty quickly, all things considered. Like, you go back to the days of Norton Utilities defragmenting your old HFS classic hard drive. Like, the fact that this was something that was introduced with an OS upgrade is pretty remarkable.
It makes me think of the metaphor of like building the airplane as you go.
Yeah.
Except this is like Delta saying that they're going to replace parts on every airplane they own while they're flying in the air in one day.
For everybody.
For everybody. It'll be fine. And they all landed safely. Like, wow.
Pretty great.
Yeah, that's the kind of technology that Apple can bring to bear on macOS now. And thinking of the current version, which is macOS 11 Big Sur, we've gone to 11. I think it's kind of nice and fitting that two decades in, we've said, okay, that was a big arc. We stopped calling it macOS 10. We got rid of the X. It was still in the version number, but we can move on. We're going to do a ton of technical stuff for another major transition, the M1 transition. I mean, hell, we're going to run iOS apps on these things.
Right, yeah.
So huge underpinning changes to the operating system. You say, well, that would be well and good enough. And they said, and we did a complete redesign of it that is the biggest visual redesign that we've done maybe since Aqua. I mean, there have been a couple of intermediate redesigns in the meantime with Mavericks, the flattening. But I would say this is at least as big of a step and probably bigger. That's how big the beast is, that they can add on just for funsies a huge visual redesign of macOS.
Yeah, and there have been a couple of times in this episode where we've talked about people back then trying to forecast forward, like whether it's will quote unquote macOS 10 be the foundation for other operating systems so far into the future, or will macOS 10 even exist as an operating system so far into the future? But here we are 20 years later, and right on the heels of a major new release, like new interface, new architectures that it supports. And I think that's an indication, if nothing else is, that the Mac and the macOS will continue as this thing, this standalone thing, for many more years.
Fast forward 20 more years, and I think it's reasonably confident to say that there will be a platform called macOS.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know what it'll look like, but it seems almost a certainty. The version number will probably be 31, but hey, we'll figure that out later.
It'll be lower than Chrome.
Is there anything else to add on about the legacy of macOS? I mean, we can say that now that we've dropped the 10 and moved to 11, that we can not only celebrate this milestone, but close a chapter, a soft closing. We're not putting it in mm-hmm. the ground like macOS 9. But we can say what else is there to say about what that 19 plus years of operating system history did for us.
One thing you can point out is that it's already lasted longer than the classic macOS did.
Oh, by a long shot.
And in its longer lifespan, it has not just weathered this transition from x86 to Apple Silicon, but it made 32 to 64 bit transitions with PowerPC, of course, PowerPC to Intel. And because there were those weak little core solos, 32-bit to 64-bit Intel as well. So it is really spanned like eras of computing. Again, it didn't even come with a browser at first. So that whole paradigm has changed. It's spanned hardware. It's spanned basically what Apple kind of represents as a company. It went from the Mac company to the iPod company to the iPhone services revenue, but we're a TV channel, everything company. It's been there the entire time, Mac OS X specifically.
Yeah. And I think the references to the hardware platforms really shows that we're marking the anniversary of a huge inflection point, one of these just cliffs, right? Mm-hmm. Where everything changed when macOS 10.0 was released. And we haven't had an everything changed moment in the operating system since then, even though we've had two everything changed in the hardware since then. What makes the hardware of a Mac now and what made the hardware of a Mac in 2001 just completely, I mean, like, if you can get a USB-A port on your current Mac, that's like the closest thing that overlaps
right.
between then and now. Just everything has changed out with lots of sharp turns along the way and these huge cliffs that things fall off of, whereas macOS has been this gradual through line and continues on.
Yeah.
So I think that wraps up this special episode of Simple Beep. I don't know what our next big milestone might be. We said when we signed off of the last regular episode that there may be things in the future. This is the first of those.
Yeah,
and there may still be more to come. If you've been missing me and Brian, though, we have been doing another podcast for the past year, something that we were not able to announce on Simple Beep previously. But we have a show called One More Thing, which is, yes, that's a tip of the hat to you, the classic Apple nerds, with our friend E. Forney, where every couple of weeks, we each pick a topic of something that we have gotten super into for whatever reason. They can be current or they can be old things that we're discovering or things that we're rediscovering. We cover TV, movies, video games, sports, music, food, culture, all kinds of things. We have a very cool list of all the topics that we've done that you can see on the website for that podcast, which is onemorething.show. So we'd love it if you check that out. A little bit of a different vibe, but we have fun doing that, and we're really happy that we're still on the microphone every couple of weeks.
And of course, if you want to see the show notes for this episode or check out our back catalog and all of those episodes' show notes, we still, of course, maintain simplebeep.com, and you can find Simple Beep in your podcast app of choice, whichever one supports the iTunes directory. Is it still called that? iTunes. iTunes came and went in the 20 years of Mac OS X.
Sure did. We're keeping the feed and all the episodes online as long as we find it to be practicable, and it still is. And of course, if there ever does come a point where we have to transition those off, you know, we'll make sure that everything's up on the Internet Archive or something and give everybody ample notice. But for now, yeah, the feed is still there. Don't send in feedback, though, because it might be a very long time before right. You get any response.
Similarly, even though feedback may not show up in a future episode's follow-up, Ed still maintains the @simple_beep Twitter account, which is a great follow, I will say. If you like listening to this podcast, just follow it on Twitter, and you may not be able to listen to it, you know, every 2 weeks or every month, but little nuggets will pop into your feed, and it's a delight.
Right. There's always little reminiscences, little classic Apple news, stuff that comes up, you know, art being made with classic Macs, gems that, Stephen Troughton Smith or John Syracuse have come up with. And, you know, whenever I see those things, I don't put them out on my personal account. I've got Simple Beep for that, which makes me happy. You know, things that even when we were doing the show regularly wouldn't fill out a full episode. That stream of stuff is never going away.
And of course, we do have personal Twitter accounts. I'm at Bsuto, Bsuto.
And I'm at Ecormany, Ecormany. Thanks for listening, and enjoy the next 20 years of macOS, everybody.